Hello and welcome to The Wire, your independent national coverage of a current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Amina Shakur coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. And today on the show...
That across all of that research, most people who believed they reacted to gluten actually showed no differences when given gluten versus placebo.
And new research reveals that gluten is not the villain.
So when we were made aware that this was happening on the 10th of October, we jumped straight on it to say we need to do a campaign against this.
The blind community condemns viral trend mocking vision loss. And later today...
So they play a fundamental role in the global carbon cycle. They actually draw down carbon to the deep.
Urgent need to protect Antarctic krill and marine life remains unmet. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. New research is turning what we thought we knew about gluten sensitivity on its head. A major international study led by Associate Professor Jessica Beskeski from the University of Melbourne has found that most people who believe they react to gluten may actually be responding to other factors. I spoke with Associate Professor Beskeski about how the findings could change how millions of people are treated.
In this research, what we have done is we have critically evaluated all of the existing gluten-related research to understand if gluten really causes symptoms in people who believe they are gluten sensitive. It's important to understand that this is outside of celiac disease. We already understand that celiac disease is a well-characterized, well-understood autoimmune disorder where gluten triggers the immune system in those people and attacks their gut lining, and gluten-free diet is the only medical treatment in a very strict lifelong approach. The group of people that we're looking at in this particular research is outside of celiac disease, and where we see about 10% of the population reporting non-celiac gluten intolerance. And what this research has challenged is that across all of that research, most people who believed they reacted to gluten actually showed no differences when given gluten versus placebo. So in other words, although their symptoms are real, gluten itself isn't the trigger. So gluten is getting the unnecessary blame, and rather the evidence is showing that the culprit is often fermentable carbohydrates like fructans that are found in wheat, or the way that the brain is actually interpreting sensations from the gut.
I think that kind of leads on to my second question of, if gluten isn't the main course, what triggers people with non-celiac gluten sensitivity? I know you mentioned, was it the fermented
carbohydrates?
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So it's important to perhaps define gluten first. So gluten is a protein that is found in wheat, rye and barley. So found in lots of cereal and grain products, bread, pasta, cakes, croissants, muffins, etc. And in your wheat, rye and barley grain, not only do we have that gluten protein component, we also have a carbohydrate component. And the carbohydrate component is called a fructan. This carbohydrate component is rapidly fermentable, and we actually have really good evidence already to understand how fructans and other similar fermentable carbohydrates that are found in other foods can trigger these same types of symptoms that non-celiac gluten sensitive people are reporting. And therefore, it is perhaps gluten is being misblamed when it may be something like the fermentable carbohydrates. And I could give you your listeners perhaps a bit of an example. So if we think about a bowl of spaghetti bolognese, in that spaghetti you have gluten being the protein, but you also have fructans being the carbohydrate component. That's just the pasta itself. Then you have the bolognese sauce. And in that sauce, you're probably adding vegetables, including onion and garlic, which are also fermentable carbohydrates. So after having a big bowl of spaghetti bolognese or a small bowl of spaghetti bolognese, and you're feeling like you have an upset tummy, you go to Google. Google tells you it's probably gluten because that's the first thing that the celebrity endorsements and the wellness influencers will tell us, and therefore Google tells us. But it's probably not gluten. It may have been the build-up of all of those fermentable carbohydrates as well contributing.
And is there a way to avoid that or detect that in a way?
Unfortunately, not an easy way. So if we compare it to celiac disease, we have a really easy and accurate blood test that can be done. So if people do believe that gluten or cereal and grain products are triggering symptoms, I encourage you to go see a GP and first get that immune blood test. They can look for those immune markers. You do already need to have gluten in your diet. Once you start removing gluten from your diet, that immune reaction is reducing or no longer occurring. So before you start playing around with a restrictive diet, it is important you see your GP. If we look at gluten sensitivity, because the evidence is actually very mixed and inconsistent, which is what we've found in this research, we don't actually have a clear biomarker. This means you can't go to your GP and get tested for gluten sensitivity if it's not celiac disease. And it's rather very much self-reported based on symptoms that are being experienced and identifying a diet or a food relationship with when symptoms are being experienced.
I guess speaking about gut and brain connection, how important is it when it comes to, you know, scenarios like this?
Very important. So what we now understand from this research is that gluten sensitivity, we think, is part of a broader gut-brain interaction where the digestive system, so our gut, and the nervous system, being our brain, that interaction and how the brain is amplifying sensations from the gut is really important. And this means that effectively the way that the brain is interpreting sensations from the gut is really strongly influencing symptoms. So the symptoms are real, but rather it's how what we are expecting to happen can really strongly shape how we feel.
That was Associate Professor Jessica Bezkeski from the University of Melbourne speaking to The Wire. Many people who are blind or low vision have called social media giants to embrace stricter protections against harmful content in the wake of a new trend gaining popularity online. The viral social media hashtags, hashtag blind challenge and hashtag blind kid challenge, promotes users without disability to imitate or rather mock members of the blind community in the name of entertainment, audience viewership and social media engagement, according to Guide Dogs, New South Wales and ACT. Powered Media's Emma Myers spoke with General Manager of Social Change at Guide Dogs, New South Wales and ACT, Tamara Sirant, to find out more.
Tamara, tell me a little bit about this specific social media trend and why it's confronting and a bit of a backward step for the community.
So unfortunately, we became aware of this trend where there are hashtags like hashtag blind challenge and hashtag blind kid challenge. And unfortunately, it's a social media trend where parents ask their children to act like someone with low vision or blindness. Unfortunately, what it is doing is instilling negative stereotypes, which is really quite harmful to the low vision and blindness community. Where in 2025, you wouldn't expect that you'd be coming across challenges like this on social media. So when we were made aware that this was happening on the 10th of October, we jumped straight on it to say we need to do a campaign against this.
And is it a big thing here in Australia? Because I know it's huge over in America.
It is quite a big trend in America, in the US. It hasn't necessarily had the same level of pickup here in Australia, but there are some parents jumping on it. And so our mission is to do our best to educate people now before more people jump on the challenge. As soon as we heard about it, we contacted the social media companies, and we've been told that they are reviewing the issue. So we made sure it went to their communications and trust and safety team so that they can actually address it directly. We've also built out a campaign page where we're highlighting our position on this and that it isn't acceptable, and that we need to make sure that these kind of trends are not something that we need to have in 2025. We have actually put on our campaign page a call to action for people to be able to jump on it and actually raise awareness on it to their local MP or even the eSafety Commissioner. So the hope is we can actually rally enough awareness so that people take action, address it, and we collectively as Australian citizens go, this is not what we're about. In our opinion, respect is more important than views.
What sort of community-wide response has this had via the disability community, but also the wider community?
So from the guide dogs community, straight up, people are just disgusted and have been saying to us that it's just harmful and something needs to be done now. Something that people have been saying is, you know, it really is a reflection of ignorance, unfortunately, but it's also disregard for people who are blind or have low vision. And it's not something that we should be joking about in today's age, and it's not teaching young audiences what inclusion's about. I think the people that we've been speaking to date in the social media companies and anyone else we've been speaking to, values aligned organizations, have also had the same response. So I think the most important thing here is getting that message out there more broadly so people can go, oh, that's not okay. So we can take people on the journey that this is actually something that needs to be addressed now, that this doesn't actually empower people, and that we need to create a more inclusive social media online presence.
And ideally, what kind of response would you like to see from the government in broadening protections for people with disability on social media? What sorts of implementations would you like to see?
I think there is a bit of a two-pronged approach to this. On one side of it, I think it's important that the government comes out and condemns this kind of trend so that people become aware that it isn't a trend that is acceptable. But secondly, in acknowledging the government's age restriction policy that's coming into play, I think this whole issue demonstrates that there is a need for protections against discriminatory behaviour online, and there is a need to be able to support the eSafety Commissioner in being able to hold platforms accountable when it comes to this kind of discriminative behaviour. We really need to go back to thinking about how social media is a real opportunity for connection and creativity and inclusion, and not an avenue for mocking people. And that's why it's so important that we start thinking more broadly about what we're doing online and how can we make sure we create a community that is respectful, inclusive and kind.
Sarah Searant from Guide Dogs New South Wales and ACT speaking with Powered Media's Emma Myers. A spokesperson for Guide Dogs New South Wales and ACT contacted Powered Media shortly after the initial story was published. The representative says TikTok responded to their request, claiming in an email to have banned the hashtag Blind Kid Challenge and removed hundreds of videos they deemed to violate their policies. You're listening to The Wire on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Amin Shkur in Melbourne. A big hello to our listeners in Alice Springs on 8CCC 102.1 FM, and to our friends in Noosa on Noosa FM 101.3, and to the other side of the country to Radio Goolari in Broome, Western Australia. Last week, the Commission for Conservation of Antarctic Marine Living Resources gathered in Hobart to discuss more on protecting marine life in the Antarctic. The Antarctic krill is one of the many species needing protection from fishing, as it's vital for the ecosystem and it's not protected. It will endanger the Antarctic Peninsula. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan started asking Ocean Conservation Manager at WWF Australia, Emily Grilly, how important the Antarctic krill is in the ecosystem.
Antarctic krill are tiny crustaceans that live in the waters around Antarctica, and they are absolutely central to the Southern Ocean food web. so much of the wildlife in Antarctica, from whales, who are the largest consumers of krill, to penguins, seals, fish, seabirds. Basically, all of these animals rely on krill to survive. They also play a really important ecosystem service. So they play a fundamental role in the global carbon cycle. They actually draw down carbon to the deep. And so we often refer to them as the powerhouses or superheroes of the Southern Ocean.
Now, the Commission for the Conservation of Antarctic Marine Living Resources ended up in Hobart last week. Was there any agreement on protecting the krill at all?
So the biggest risk to krill is that there's a large-scale industrial krill fishery that operates around the Antarctic Peninsula. And this is also one of the highest areas of biodiversity in the Southern Ocean. So under CAMLR's mandate, CAMLR's objective is first and foremost the conservation of wildlife. The fishery must be managed in a precautionary and ecosystem-based manner. So this means management must consider uncertainties in their decision-making, like climate change. And they also have to consider the wider impacts of the fishery on the ecosystem. And this isn't happening. So the management's been outdated for many years now. We've been calling for an updated and new management framework. The majority of CAMLR nations have been trying to work towards this, including Australia. However, this year there was again no agreement. And this also follows a really quite a heartbreaking meeting in 2024, where a critical protection measure for krill and their predators was actually allowed to expire.
So besides protection, what else is WWF looking from this commission to protect the ecosystem across the Antarctic Peninsula?
So in addition to the stronger fishery management regulations, WWF really wants CAMLR to deliver on a commitment that they made in 2009 to establish a representative system of marine protected areas around the continent. So this would provide essentially a network of protection for wildlife and their critical habitats. So there were four proposals for marine protected areas on the table this year. Some of these have been negotiated for over 10 years now. And again, no progress was made. So this is something that we're really watching, and we're really looking for them to progress in the next year. The most critical region needing the protection is the Antarctic Peninsula. This is where both the krill fishery operates and also under increasing pressure from climate change, as it's one of the most rapidly warming regions on the planet.
Now, what would happen to the Antarctic krill? You mentioned there's a lot of factors that is, contributing to be endangered or something like that. What would happen to the Antarctic krill and the environment if there are no established protections in the area?
Well, because they're such a central component of the ecosystem, if protections are not put in place, right now there's a significant risk that the fishery could have further negative impacts on the ecosystem. Given the nature of how they're fishing now, so with the lapse of that critical protection measure, that actually spread out the operations of the fishery. Now that that's lapsed, the fishing vessels can actually concentrate their effort in very small areas and these sort of fishing hotspots. And so this is a risk that could trigger local ecosystem collapse. So say if there's a Delhi penguin population right next to that fishing hotspot that relies on that krill source for their food, and that's taken away, or there's limited availability now because these fishing vessels have scooped it all up, then that penguin colony could essentially collapse after several years of this.
And what can the Australian government do to enforce and promote protections across this area in on Antarctica?
The Australian government, they have a long history of leadership in Antarctic conservation. However, it feels like it's almost being forgotten about at the higher level. We really need our ministers to be elevating this issue in their, bilateral discussions with other CAMLR nations. We need to see increased collaboration with CAMLR countries that's not just at the meeting times or right in the lead up to CAMLR every year, but actually throughout the year, because this is the only way that we're going to address the barriers to conservation.
Emily Grilly from the WWF Australia there, speaking with the Wire's Eduardo Jordan. Ovarian Cancer Australia is encouraging Australians to get moving this November with its National Fitness Challenge, Workout for Women. Now in its fourth year, the campaign invites participants to take on 40, 80 or 120 kilometres over the month, either walking, running, cycling or swimming, to raise funds for women living with ovarian cancer. The Wise Azucena Carrasco spoke with Ovarian Cancer Australia CEO Debbie Scheel to talk about Workout for Women.
Debbie, for listeners who may not know, what is Workout for Women and what inspired Ovarian Cancer Australia to launch this national challenge?
It is a national challenge. Workout for Women is a national movement led by Ovarian Cancer Australia, and it's all about moving for meaning. What's great about this year's Workout for Women is you can set your own challenge. So you can move for 40 kilometres, 80 kilometres or 120 kilometres throughout the month of November. Mm-hmm. You can move in any way that suits you or that you like, that inspires you, walking, running, cycling or swimming, however you choose to get active. And we launched Workout for Women as a way for Australians to come together and to, as a movement of solidarity. Every kilometre everybody walks is like walking alongside women with ovarian cancer. It encourages conversations and breaks some of the silence around ovarian cancer and also raises vital funds to support women with ovarian cancer.
Okay, and so would you think that that is why the movement is so powerful? Just through exactly that, a move for women. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I think people are seeing now the silence around women's health is finally starting to break in Australia. And there is a movement really starting about women's health being under-recognised, under-diagnosed, under-researched and underfunded. And ovarian cancer is the quintessential example of how we have let women down. So that's why Workout for Women is such an important opportunity for all of Australia to get together and to raise awareness of ovarian cancer and the impacts and to stand in solidarity with women and families facing ovarian cancer today.
Because it is a movement, a supporting movement. It is actually encouraging people to open up through that movement in action. And they can join and we will share the details for how to do that. But I want to come back to ovarian cancer because it is known as the most lethal female cancer in Australia. Is that right? Could you tell us what are some of the biggest challenges that women face when they are diagnosed?
Yeah, it's the worst words you want to hear as a woman, to be told that you're diagnosed with ovarian cancer, which is the most lethal of the gynecological cancers. Sadly, ovarian cancer doesn't have an early detection test, and the symptoms are often vague and they're often missed because they can be so general. Things like bloating, frequent urination, pain in the belly. There's lots of common symptoms that can sometimes be misdiagnosed. And I think that combined with the lack of research, it means that once you get diagnosed, the grim facts are that 49% of women who are diagnosed with ovarian cancer will be still alive in 5 years' time. And we also know that, sadly, 70% of women will have a reoccurrence within 3 years. We have to do something to change this story. We have to do something together. And we know we can start a movement. We know we can. That's why Workout for Women is so exciting to us, because it gets people out and active and talking about ovarian cancer and raising funds to support those who are facing it today.
Yeah, those funds raised through Workout for Women, what difference can it make in women and families that are affected by ovarian cancer?
Yes, well, there's lots of things that Ovarian Cancer Australia and the ovarian cancer community do to change the future story. We advocate for healthcare reform and additional research funding, and we know that sort of change takes time. So we raise funds to support women and families today. So we need to raise funds to run a helpline, and we also need to raise funds for our clinical support, nursing support services, and also our psychological and counselling services that we provide to women and their families as they go through the myriad of twists and turns that come with an ovarian cancer diagnosis and the treatment journey.
That was Ovarian Cancer Australia CEO Debbie Scheel speaking with The Wire's Azucena Carrasco. And unfortunately, that is the end of today's show. Thanks so much for listening wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2ACR in Sydney, Radio Adelaide 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Brisbane, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and Community Radio Network. Check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, X and LinkedIn. The Wire acknowledges the traditional Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of Kulin Nations, the traditional custodians of the lands where the program is produced. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. I'm Amina Shukur coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks so much for your company and we'll see you next time on The Wire. Yeah.